Picture how your life might be if you knew the day you would die. How would that affect the way you live that day? Or, for that matter, your entire life leading up to that day? Would you ignore it? Would you practice a casual shuck and jive? Would you indulge in a heedless hedonism? Would you embrace the love in your life, or would you shiver in cold fear and loathing? Chloe Benjamin's new novel, The Immortalists, deals with these and other questions. Chloe definitely avoided the sophomore slump with this, her second work of fiction, a New York Times bestseller. I spoke with Chloe earlier this week about The Immortalists. Chloe Benjamin, welcome to Express Yourself.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for writing a book that kept me turning the pages all weekend long. It was not a waste of time, so thank you.
Oh, good. I hope not to write waste of time books.
Well, I haven't read your first one, which was The Anatomy of Dreams, but after reading The Immortalists, I have to read that, I think. But are you happy with the way Immortalists has turned out?
I am. I mean, it's been a really amazing experience, and that's a question. I like your question because that's not one that I usually get asked. It's certainly been a whirlwind, and I'm prone to anxiety, so not without its stressors, but my publishing house has just been so, so phenomenal and worked so hard to bring this book to readers, and it's been amazing to see readers enjoying it too.
How long did it take you to write this book, Chloe Benjamin?
Well, it took about 2.5 years for a first draft, and then from there I would say it was another 2 or so years working with my publisher, doing edits and revisions for them, starting to plan ahead for publicity and marketing. So, 4.5, 5 years from conception until now.
Wow. So you've lived with this thing for 4 or 5 years. How about that?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I think it was in part the research that took a particularly long time for this book. It covers about 50 years and 4 different people's lives. And so I really wanted to make sure that I was doing all of that work as authentically and with as much integrity as I could. If it were just the writing, it would have probably been shorter, but there was a lot of other work involved too.
The research is obvious, and actually that was one of my later questions. But let's start with the premise of the book, which is, how would you react if you knew the date of your death? And you frame that question in the lives of 4 characters, all part of a family. What happened to those 4 children in 1969?
Well, they hear of the arrival of a mysterious woman who is rumored to be able to tell anyone the date that they will die. And the siblings are, they're in this curious historical moment. Like you said, it's 1969. There's so much happening in the world, but they're kids. And so there's not a whole lot happening to them. And so they decide that they're going to do this adventurous errand, and it winds up impacting the rest of their lives
in ways that one can barely imagine, but it's a fascinating question. Let's talk about some of the characters. Very rich, very sympathetic characters. Let's start with the youngest, Simon. Describe Simon for our listeners.
Well, it's not given too much away since this all comes out in the first 30 pages or so, but Simon knows that he's gay. He's growing up in a conservative Jewish family, and he knows that they would not approve. And he uses the prophecy as motivation to start living the life that he wants. And so he leaves home at 16, and he runs away to San Francisco.
And he ends up there late 70s, right, and living into the early 80s.
Right. Yeah. And so, I think if you know the timeline, that, it's clear that San Francisco is moving into the AIDS crisis. But for me, his section of the book is less about, a kind of suspense or thriller-esque question about, what he eventually finds himself in the middle of, as it is an exploration of this moment in time and this community who has finally found a safe place in which to express themselves and then is hit by unimaginable tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you bring that tragedy to life so well in the guise of the lover that Simon finds. Robert, describe Robert's and Simon's relationship, if you would.
Yeah, well, Robert is also a gay man, but he, in addition, is an African-American man. And one of the things that was interesting to me in researching for Simon's section was finding out how white the Castro was. Castro was the famous, you know, gay neighborhood in San Francisco. And even though, you know, the gay men who lived there were maligned and victims of oppression themselves, in some ways that culture kind of reinforced traditional power structures. Like I said, it was a really white world, and people of color faced an enormous risk to their safety in San Francisco at the time. So Robert is, you know, I didn't want him to simply be a symbol of that. He is his own person, but he's also able to reflect back to Simon a different perspective.
And, you know, Simon went to San Francisco with his sister, Clara, and Clara called Robert classy in the book. And I would say that Simon comes to two or three very transcendent moments, one of them being the first time that he tells Robert, "I love you," which is on stage, no less. And the other,
yeah.
I mean, you know, what a glorious way to say "I love you" to the person you love when he's holding you aloft as if you are flying. On stage.
yeah. So what you're referring to is that they are dancers. So Simon, he becomes a dancer when he moves to San Francisco. And, you know, he struggles to be honest with his feelings, even as he, you know, has a really robust sense of his sexuality. And so that's the moment where he's able to be vulnerable, but in a kind of unexpected stage.
Yes, and the other transcendent moment in the Simon section was his deathbed scene. Oh my God, I wonder if you'd be kind enough to read part of that for us.
Yes, absolutely. "Oh, sigh. There is a strangled cry like something that would come from a chained dog. Clara puts a palm over her mouth when she realizes it's hers. I wish, don't wish it. Look what she gave me. This," says Clara, looking at the lesions on his arms, his sharp ribs, even his blonde mane has thinned. After an aide helps him bathe, the drain is matted with curls. "No," says Simon, "this," and he points at the window. "I would never have come to San Francisco if it weren't for her. I wouldn't have met Robert. I'd never have learned how to dance. Probably still be home waiting for my life to begin." He's angry with the disease. He rages at the disease. For so long, he hated the woman, too. How, he wondered, could she give such a terrible fortune to a child? But now he thinks of her differently, like a second mother or a god, she who showed him the door and said, "Go." Clara looks paralyzed. Simon remembers the expression he saw on her face after they moved to San Francisco, that eerie combination of irritation and indulgence, and he realizes why it disturbed him. She reminded him of the woman, counting down, watching him. Inside him, a bud of love for his sister breaks open. He thinks of her on the rooftop, how she stood at the edge and spoke without looking at him. "Give me one good reason why you shouldn't start your life." "You aren't surprised that it's Sunday," Simon says. "You knew all along." "Your date," Clara whispers. "You said it was young. I wanted you to have everything you've ever wanted." Simon squeezes Clara's hand. Her palm is fleshy, a healthy pink. "But I do," he says.
That is just gorgeous. Thank you for writing that.
thank you.
You know, I can't say that Simon's siblings came to the same kind of transcendent understanding of the kind of gift and curse that the gypsy woman gave them. And you know, Simon was the first to die. He was the youngest. He was only 20 when he died. Mm-hmm. And yet he came to the understanding that you just read. And that's really remarkable. And as I said, his siblings, a couple of them, weren't as lucky. We don't really have to get into Clara and Daniel, although both of them are equally compelling characters, and each in their way comes to a partial understanding, I would say, of what it was that the gypsy woman fortune teller did for them. But I want to focus a little bit on Varya, because I would say that Varya, who's the eldest of the four, in her own way came to an equally deep understanding. She is a longevity researcher, isn't she?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And tell me...
You're right. So she is... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So she is researching how to extend the human lifespan. And what she wants to do is not just to extend lifespan, but to extend health span, the healthy years of one's life. Because, after all, it might not be so much good to live a long time if you're not in very good shape. So that's what she's working on.
Uh-huh. And she also suffers from obsessive compulsive disorder, doesn't she?
She does. Yeah. I think she, you know, she's racked by a sense of guilt and responsibility after what happened to her family. And the OCD for her is a way to organize and control her life.
Yeah. By the time that Varya comes to an understanding of what she's dealing with here, all three of her siblings have died. A couple of them none of them really in a very savory manner. But Varya's understanding of the whole dynamic comes to her through a journalist who comes to interview her mm-hmm. and her research, and this journalist is not exactly what he appears to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. So the mystery of the final section is this cat and mouse between somebody who is coming to the lab where Varya works and is carrying out her study and interviewing her, and he begins to challenge her about her life and her expectations. And I won't give away the twist, but I think that she experiences a transformation because of him.
She does. She does indeed. In fact, she does a complete 180, doesn't she? Pretty much. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I think that in comparison to all of her siblings, Varya probably undergoes the most change, which is interesting because you don't necessarily expect that that's going to be the case. But she starts out living with a lot of rigidity, and, her attempts at control have made her live a pretty narrow life in some ways. And by the end of the section, she's... she's able to see something different.
Chloe, do you read the comics?
I haven't in some time. I used to. Why do you ask?
A couple of months ago, Mother Goose and Grimm. Are you familiar with that one? There's two dogs in that family.
I'm not.
One named Grimmy and one named Ralph, and they're hanging out on their mother's on their mother's sofa. You know, just hanging on the arms of the sofa, and Grimmy turns to Ralph and goes, "Ralph, what would you do tomorrow if you knew you were gonna die?" And do you know what Ralph says?
Nothing.
Ralph says, "I'd wake up early."
That's good. I like that one.
I thought of that. I thought of that as I read your book, because you're dealing with the eternal verities here, and in a way that, isn't a treatise. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I didn't want to write a book that was telling anyone how to feel about these big questions, but rather I hope it's one that will prompt conversation and allow people to think through some of these questions for themselves.
You bring in so many threads in this family story, and this gets back at the research that you is so obviously prodigious. And you know, you obviously did your research about 1980 San Francisco, about magic because Clara was a magician, about the Romani or the gypsy people because, of course, it was a gypsy lady that you know, that gave this prophecy to the kids. Longevity research, all of it, mental illness is in there. There's a lot going on. It's a pretty remarkable summation of where we've been in the last 40 or 50 years.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. I certainly feel like you can't write about 50 years without writing about the country in which those years take place. And it was fascinating to see how resonant many of these issues still are. You know, just as the characters of the early 20th century are dealing with immigration and discrimination, so too we find ourselves dealing with that in our culture today. That's just one example of many, you know. I mean, gay rights, feminism, there's so much that we continue to return to as Americans, and I hope we continue to see progress.
Did you have a pretty clear idea of the characters and the plot before you did your research, or did a lot of those details of character and plot evolve as you did the research?
I think it was a little bit of both. I tend to have an idea of where I want something to end up. So I did know, you know, the first three sections, I wanted them to end a certain way. I had an idea of the ending for the book, but some of those did change. And that's kind of the fun part. So even though I'm somebody who struggles with change and uncertainty, I think that my fiction is one of the rare places where I embrace it. And I think the kind of playfulness and the delight of a first draft is the part that I enjoy the most.
Oh, interesting. Well, before I let you go, Chloe, I have to ask you, if you knew the date of your death, would you want to know that?
I don't think I would, because if it were bad news, it would just be too hard not to ruminate and feel sorry for myself. I wish I could say I'd be somebody who grabbed life by the horns, but I think more likely I'd be crying over in a corner asking, why me? So I would say no. What about you?
You know, I think I don't think it matters, to tell you the truth, because you're going to live, I don't know, if you're living a pretty realized life, I mean, nobody's perfect, but if you're aware that that's sort of the reason why we're all here is to spiritually evolve, then, you know, there's a due date. I don't know. I guess we're all going to die, and I guess, I don't know, I guess it's the choice between knowledge and mystery is what we're talking about here, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting perspective. You know, I love talking with people about this stuff because I certainly don't have all the answers just because I wrote the book. So, you know, I'm learning too.
Huh. Well, Chloe Benjamin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's a splendid read, and I guess you can get it just about anywhere. Is that right, the book?
Yeah, I would say so. I always say support your local indies, indie bookstores. They've been so wonderful to this book. You should be able to get it wherever books are sold, as they say.
Well, good luck with your next one. I wait with bated breath. I'm going to have to read The Anatomy of Dreams. And do you have a good idea for your next one already, or is that still forming?
I do. And in fact, I'm so excited about the idea that I don't say anything about it because I'm afraid somebody will take it if I do. So I think there's my superstition coming in, but I am at work on it.
Okay. Chloe, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This was such a pleasure.
Likewise. Take care now. Chloe Benjamin, author of The Immortalists. And last week she stood at number 13 on the New York Times bestseller list.